Brothers and sisters in Christ Jesus, I want to start off by thanking the brothers and sisters in Texas for their warm hospitality towards me and my family. It is very much appreciated. This morning is the start of a new year. However, the title that I've been given is "There is Nothing New Under the Sun." I remember reading an article about a discussion in Washington, D.C. at the turn of the century in 1899. The discussion was whether they should have a big celebration in 1900 and ring in the new century by closing down the U.S. Patent Office, because everything that could possibly be invented had already been invented. No need for the patent office after the turn of the century. That was before there were jet planes or rockets or computers or cell phones or TVs, and we could go on and on. Remember, it was only 200 years ago that the fastest means of transportation was still the horse. And it wasn't until 1831 that a British scientist built the first electric generator. When Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 1 the statement that there was nothing new under the sun, you might say, well, maybe he could say that when he looked around him, but can we? To say that there is nothing new under the sun does not ignore inventions or advances in technology. Rather, these innovations do not amount to any basic change in the world. In Solomon's time, many advances took place in society. Remember, David was an inventor of musical instruments, so there were new technologies. But from the larger perspective of life that he was looking at, human nature has remained and always will remain the same. The book of Ecclesiastes is an autobiographical poem, the journal of the preacher's inward life. As a man of ripe wisdom and mature experience, he takes us into his confidence. He opens up the secret volume and invites us to read it with him. And he lays out before us what he has thought, what he has done, what he has seen, what he has felt, what he has suffered. And then, after he takes us through all his experiments, he asks us to listen to the judgment which he has deliberately formed, after he has considered everything that he could do. But he lays bare his heart to us, and he presents himself to us through poetry. This dramatic preacher brings himself on the stage of his poem and permits us to hear his most penetrating utterances, confesses his most secret and inward experiences, and enables us to realize the message and to judge him as well as ourselves and all others who live likewise. Instead of giving us a clear statement of the moral problem that he is about to discuss, he opens with the utterances of a man who becomes weary with trying so many futile endeavors. And so he gathers up his remaining strength to recount and to share with us all his experiments that he has tried and the conclusion that he comes to. He opens very abruptly with the words of the preacher that was at Jerusalem. But what a pathetic, disparaging introduction he gives us. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. What profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. What Solomon was emphasizing in his opening statement was the emptiness of living the rat race and the cyclic nature of human life here on the earth. He continues, verse 5, the sun also rises, and the sun goeth down, and it hastens to the place where it arose. The wind bloweth towards the south, and turneth to the north. It whirleth about continually, and the wind returneth again according to its circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. All things are full of labor. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. The things that hath been is that which shall be, and that which is done is that which shall be done. And there is no new thing under the sun. Is there anything wherever it may be said, see, this is new? It hath been already of old time, which was before us. There is no remembrance of former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of things that are to come with those that shall come after. And so we have the pathetic, disparaging introduction. Vanity of vanities. In the Jewish idiom, we remember the Holy of Holies. That's the absolute most holy. And he says, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. Solomon is dramatically describing life here on earth and the folly of that existence when God is left out. No matter how exciting life may seem to be, ultimately, in the end, it is of no value. When life here on earth is lived without God, it is a useless life. What he is saying in poetic expression is, for all man's labors, for all his effort, he gains nothing. Earthly activities are repetitive and unfulfilling. A generation goeth and a generation cometh, but the earth remaineth forever. There's a transientness about human existence on the earth which really fails to bring us in touch with something that is absolutely new or different. Dan started off this weekend by showing that religion today is just a reworked over version of Nimrod's traditions. Since there is nothing new, if we root our hope in future generations or that in time things will improve, we are setting ourselves up for disappointment. It simply will not be that much different. Nothing ever really changes except the faces, the names, the methods, perhaps the social and political dynamics. But that's all. In fact, history simply repeats itself, and no great thing emerges from under the sun that changes the essence of our existence here on earth. We're born, we live, we die. Others are born, they live, they die. The world is a very repetitive place. Nothing ever changes. So any search for real meaning and lasting profit cannot come from anything that is done under the sun. And Solomon gives us some examples from nature. The sun, wind, water. in the natural world. They're just cyclic. It's simply repeated over and over and over again, taking the objective observer to the conclusion there is nothing new under the sun. The sun rises and the sun goeth down and hastens to the place where it rose. It is a weary and hopeless existence to wait for the earth or for the human race to come up with something perfectly revolutionary. Solomon wants us to know and to understand it ain't happening. The sun seems to be constantly moving around the earth, but the pattern is the same every day. In the next illustration of the wind, once again, the wind gives the appearance of great commotion, but when analyzed closely, it's just going around in circles. Nothing changing at all. It's just more of the same. All things are full of weariness, he says. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. People are always looking and listening, attempting to be satisfied. But we always want more. We never find what it is that we're missing. This is especially true now in the information age. Every day we can see an endless procession of visual images. We have Comcast, YouTube, Blackberries, Netflix. We can listen to an endless stream of sounds, iPods, iPhones, iTunes, TVs, CDs, MP3s. And yet, even after all our looking, all our listening, our eyes and our ears are not satisfied. We still want to see and hear one more. Soon we're back to take in the endless processions of sounds and images. We can never get enough. There's always one more show to watch. One more game to play, one more song that we want to listen to. The eye is not full, nor is the ear. And so we keep text messaging and webcasting and Facebooking and Twittering and Flickering and whatever it is that else that we care to do. But brethren and sisters, what have we gained? What have we accomplished? Is there any profit? What does it all mean? That what has been is what will be. And what has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. As David pointed out this morning, we waste our lives on things that even we consider, if we were asked, would say it's not important. And yet, if we were to be true to ourselves and fill in that pie chart, every one of us spends our times on things that we say it's not important to me. There is no answer, no ultimate fulfillment, no meaning. Most people keep striving to get what they really want from this life to absolutely no avail. Brother Jim showed us last night, the faster means of communication simply leaves us open to more problem. Faster and more public way for the flesh to express itself. But there's nothing new. Nothing has changed. Now, Solomon doesn't intend to merely express gloom. He wants us to learn from his book, from his experiments, and he wants us to learn the lesson as early as possible, what he finally learned later in life. If we're waiting for some new thing to excite our interests, to fulfill our lives, it's futile. It's simply vanity. life is far more boring than modern man admits. Political empires rise and fall. There are periods of war followed by periods of peace, followed by periods of war again. Yogi Berra put it very well. He says it's deja vu all over again. And his brother Sean said, and I quote him, "Politics today is no different than in times past. Yahweh is working through nations to bring about his purpose. To bring about that perfect condition that politicians talk about but cannot accomplish. They may try, they may promise, but we cannot put trust or faith in any of them. One may make changes only to find the next one that comes along undoes it and makes other changes. And that's the cycle since the beginning of time. Nothing is new, all is vanity." What really changes? Communication or just the method and the speed? Illness or just the diagnostic and treatment protocols? Science is trying to bring about a utopia, but in vain. Does money really change or just the form and the use and the system of exchange that we use? How about relationships, politics, sins? Look at any subject you want. We must not confuse the methods with the essence. The essence of our existence here on earth hasn't changed. Is there anything, wherever it may be said, see, this is new? It hath been already of old time, which was before us. It is what it is. The preacher gives us another description of the world. He says, "What has been will be again. Nothing is new, and nothing gains eternal fame." The preacher's words are not contradicted by technology advances or by the fact that we can remember the names of famous people such as Caesar or Shakespeare. The fundamental events of life, birth, marriage, work, death, remains unchanged year after year, generation after generation. The desire for something new is the desire for something that alters the nature of life in this world. Cars, computers, jet airplanes may have made some things easier and faster for us, however, as for our ancestors and predecessors, the sun rises and sets. The rivers run to their courses, and the people continue their endless quest for fame, for power, for happiness, even as they all move steadily towards death and the grave. It has never changed. Never changed. The vast majority of people never achieve lasting fame, and those who do gain absolutely nothing by having achieved it. For they too, just like the unknown, simply lie decomposing in their graves. And so the preacher tells us, "For all man's labor, there is no profit under the sun." And so the conclusion, there is nothing new under the sun. Here at ground level, everything's pretty much the same, generation after generation. But, brothers and sisters, there is a God in heaven who rules over the sun. Meaning can be found in relation to him, making that long sought after ultimate perfect existence a very real possibility for each and every one of us through this which we see portrayed on the table before us through the work of Christ. All those things that make life here so weary and troublesome can have new meaning when we understand that this is just a training ground. In this life, we don't seek the ultimate or perfection or true happiness. This is simply our preparation for that time to come. So as we approach the end of the book of Ecclesiastes, we approach the end of Solomon's quest. The preacher has found the answer. And he will show to us where we too can find it. But after reading all his experiments, how he has tried everything that he could possibly try, are we even yet prepared to welcome and to lay hold of his conclusion? Apparently, brethren and sisters, he thinks we are not. For though he has already warned us that it cannot be found, he takes us through his experiments, through wealth, through industry, in pleasure, in wisdom, in folly, in merrymaking. He tried it all. And he concludes, all is vanity of vexation of spirit. But after going through all his experiments, he repeats his warning all over again, as if he is ending his book, as if he still suspects that we're going to be hankering after our old errors that's going to lead us nowhere. He doesn't really trust us that we grasp the message, that we really understand the importance of what he is telling us and what he has found through all his experiments. Not until he has again assured us that we shall miss our mark if we seek satisfaction or lasting good in any of the directions in which people commonly seek it, only then, after he repeats it again and again, does he direct us to the sole path which will not end in vanity and vexation of spirit. He begins the last chapter by exhorting us not to wait before we learn and understand what he is saying. Learn it now is his message. Learn it while you're young. Ecclesiastes 12, he starts off in the first verse. Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth, while the evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh, when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. Remember our Creator, lest forgetting him, we should waste our time and our energy in sensual excess, lest mirth should degenerate into a devotion to pleasure, lest the lust of merely physical enjoyment should outlive the power that we have to any longer enjoy them, and that we find the evil day has come, and the years arrive in which we shall say, I have no pleasure in them. You will grow old and lose pleasure in those things that were so important to us in our youth. The preacher enforces his argument in the last chapter by a brief allusion to the weariness of a godless person in old age, and by a very striking description of the terrors of the death in which this life cultivates. And he then ends his book with his final conclusion in the last two verses of the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes 12, verses 13 and 14. He says, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. God has the pie chart on us. Even if we don't look at it and we don't pay attention to it ourselves, He will bring it to light. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. But brothers and sisters, that's not what Solomon said. What he said was, fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole man. Duty of is in italics, and it doesn't belong there. And to understand exactly what Solomon was telling us, we need to join Ezekiel, and I'll close with our thoughts from Ezekiel. Ezekiel was taken to a high mountain. Ezekiel chapter 40, he tells us, in the vision of God, He brought me into the land of Israel and set me upon a very high mountain, by the which was a frame of a city on the south. From a distance, it looked to Ezekiel like a frame of a city. But as he was brought nearer, he found it to be a great temple. And in verse 3, and he brought me thither, and behold, there was a man whose appearance was like the appearance of brass, with a line of flax in his hand and a measuring reed. And he stood in the gate. The man of brass can be considered in connection with the brazen serpent in the wilderness and the brazen altar. Brass, tying together the concepts of judgment, sin's flesh, and the sacrificial work that Christ has accomplished. The man of brass standing in the gate of the temple is Christ, with a measuring reed in his hand. As Ezekiel is taken through the temple, we're told that he measured the gates and the porch, the walls, the bars, etc. But the man of brass was not only the measurer of the house, we also read that he was the builder and the maker of the house. Verse 14, he made also posts of 70 cubits, and so forth. So as he shows Ezekiel what he made, he takes him through and measures all the things that he has made as they go along. The measurer as well as the maker of the house is Christ. Christ, standing in the gate of that future temple with a measuring stick in his hand. How do we measure up? Will we fit into that house? Has our actions of the past week, month, year helped us or hurt us towards that goal? All the material of Solomon's temple was prepared off-site beforehand. When it came time for Solomon to construct the temple, each piece fit perfectly into place. 1 Kings 6, and the house when it was in building was built of stone, made ready before it was brought thither, so that there was neither hammer nor axe nor any tool of iron heard in the house while it was in building. Solomon had 80,000 workers with their supervisors away in the mountains, up in Lebanon, all over the place, preparing the pieces, and everything came together and fit perfectly into the temple. These things were written for our learning. Many different sizes, different shapes of wood and stone and different materials were required in the house, but they all had to fit. The house would not come together if any of the pieces were not shaped properly, if they didn't measure up. Christ stands in the gate with the measuring reed, the same measure for small as well as the great. All must measure up to the same standard. And we see that standard, brethren and sisters, set and portrayed here on the table before us. Ephesians 4, verse 13. Till we all come in the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God unto the perfect man, unto the whole man. Fear God, keep his commandments. This is the whole man. Unto the perfect or whole man, unto the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, Ephesians says. So how do we measure up to Christ? He will be there in the gate with the measuring reed. And brethren and sisters, now is the time for us to get into shape. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole man. Not half, not three quarters, it is the whole man. That is what our life here on earth is all about. All the summation of all the things we can do under the sun, it's all summed up in being the whole man, measuring up to the stature of Christ. Today we examine ourselves, and we measure ourselves to the measure of Christ. But one day, brethren and sisters, He will be in the gate with the measuring rod in his hand to see how well we did. Do we comprehend the measure? Or are we being led away by the cares of this world so that we will find ourselves not measuring up in that day? No place in that house. We just do not fit the specs when the measuring reed is placed near us. And brothers and sisters, if that is the case, then truly, as Solomon says, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. For indeed, there is nothing new under the sun. There is simply one purpose, one measure, and that we see on the table before us.